We're excited to announce that our very own podcasting platform, Zencastr, has become a new sponsor to the show. Check out the podcast discount link in our show notes and stay tuned for why we love using Zen for the podcast.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to The Archaeology Show. TAS goes behind the headlines to bring you the real stories about archaeology and the history around us. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Archaeology Show, episode 125. On today's show, we talk about climate change, non-kosher meals, and how making bronze coins is hard. Let's dig a little deeper. All right. Welcome to the show, everybody.
Hello.
So we are in beautiful Winnemucca, Nevada, the heart of the Great Basin.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. We're in time for Runamucca, which is great.
Yeah, it's a motorcycle and music festival. We're in an RV park on the outskirts of town. And last night, when we were just kind of hanging out, all the motorcycles came in. And now, they're all leaving.
Yes. So prepare for some background motorcycle sounds.
Rumble, rumble.
Yep.
All right. So we've got a few news articles for you, and well, a couple of news articles and a paper, and actually at least one of these links to a paper, which is pretty cool. This first one we're going to talk about.
Yeah.
Yeah, and this one is the original article we saw was written by Gizmodo, which is always interesting to me how they have people writing articles because they're more of a tech company.
I know. I'm not going to lie. When I see articles from them that are archaeology related, I often just like scroll by them because I'm like, what do they know about archaeology? But... yeah. It's actually a good one to stop on because they do bring the like technology aspect into it. That's probably why they got interested in this article or the original paper. So,
but you can tell that they really don't know what they're doing. Like there's a picture of the pyramids on here as like their cover image,
yeah.
Which I used in our newsletter. So, you know, whatever.
You know, whatever. I mean, they're, you know.
But pictures of climate models don't really come out too well.
Yeah. What are you going to show? Like a heat map? What?
Literally a climate model. Yeah. So anyway, the article's called Archaeologists Are Making a Push to Improve Climate Modeling. And this was released in May. And essentially what the start of this is that we use climate models today to try to figure out what's going to go on into the future.
Right.
And part of what those models are built on is what the past looked like, because like any good equation, you need to have good input variables in order to get good output.
Right.
So to see what things are doing right now, we can say, well, based on today and the past, we think 50 years it's going to look like this.
Yeah, like climate is cyclical, right? So like you can kind of look at the trends of the past and then get a prediction for what the future is going to look like, which seems logical. That makes sense. Totally.
Yeah. And two common places they get current data for their climate models are ice core data. So if you go up into the Arctic, Greenland is one of the places where they go a lot because Greenland has been under ice for what, hundreds of thousands of years? I mean, I don't know, millions of years?
Yeah.
It's who knows? Even when the Earth is in a warming period, Greenland is like still under ice.
Right.
So
it's one big iceberg. It's basically an iceberg island.
Yeah, essentially. So one thing you get from Greenland is you get a sense of what the air was like at that time. So the bubbles that freeze in the upper layers when like snow melts and things like that, not melts, but compacts, those bubbles that freeze are literally snapshots of the atmosphere.
Oh, yeah. Of course. That makes sense.
So when they actually unfreeze these slices of ice core data, and it gets really, really, really compact, so it's like super, super thin layers, but these tiny little bubbles are in there, and they represent the atmosphere. So when they actually heat them up and they slice them, and then they heat them up in a thing, and it's basically just... It's like a sniffer. It senses what's in the atmosphere at that time.
Cool.
So they can go back millions of years
and find
out what the atmosphere was like. Another thing they use is lake cores. And lake cores have, like, there's dust and fine settlements and pollen and all kinds of stuff that lands on the top of a lake. And that falls to the bottom. And over the course of geologic time spans, it compresses and compresses and compresses. And you get stuff like pollen, which tells you what kind of plants were around.
Right.
You get stuff like little animals and, you know, all kinds of microbes and stuff like that that are dead and fossilized or not fossilized or whatever they are in these lake core sediments. So between those two things, they got a pretty good idea what the climate looked like in the past.
Yeah, totally.
But what are they missing?
The impact of people, perhaps.
Exactly. Right. So a lot of our climate models do not take into account the past 10,000 years of human activity.
Right.
Or even farther. But farther than 10,000 years ago, 10,000, 12,000 years ago, we didn't have as big of an impact because we were more participants in the climate rather than starting to affect the climate.
Right.
But with the advent of agriculture and things like that, one statistic that I took from this that was particularly telling is, well, first off, they don't take into account how humans use the land.
Right.
And how much it impacted what the climate was going to do.
Right. And we know that that humans have a huge impact on the climate, because look at climate change right now and global warming. Obviously, we're having an impact that needs to be considered.
Yeah. So one of the things that I took away from this was one of the examples they said was around the year 1500 AD as an example, mm-hmm. Western European farmers were growing wheat and barley and used approximately, according to historical data, 2.5 acres of land per person to feed themselves, right?
Oh, yeah.
Whereas in China, growing rice paddies, in the big rice paddy fields, it was about 0.8 acres of land per person.
So really different.
Really different.
Really yeah. different, yeah.
The question I have is, what did they eat less, or was rice just like more calorie rich?
And probably the calorie rich.
They could
rich.
Eat less because of that.
Yeah, probably yeah. the calorie rich. And you can grow a lot of rice in a small area. That's
probably it too. Yeah, like wheat and barley. It's kind of spread out a little bit.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
So, I mean, how many cakes and breads can you actually make out of a field? That's what I want to know.
I mean, personally, I'll take rice any day. So that sounds like the way to go to me.
I know. I kind of love rice. I don't eat it enough, but I could probably eat it every day.
Yeah.
I don't know. When I have it, I love it. And when I don't have it, I forget about it.
Yeah. Fun trick.
Yeah.
Instant pot rice is the way to go.
I know,
you just throw that stuff in there, walk away, come back.
Even if you live in an RV.
Yeah. Anyways, tangent. Yeah,
we take 330 square feet of rice cooking per person to feed ourselves here.
Yeah, there you go.
So there you go. Not taking that into account.
Oh, my God.
Anyway, there's lots of stuff like that. Like some of the archaeologists that they talked to for this, University of Pennsylvania seems to be involved. One of the researchers, Kathleen Morrison, who is a historical anthropologist, but also specializes in, she would be like a historic palynologist, which is basically using pollen to reconstruct vegetation records, like we mentioned, looking at lake core sediments. Now, since she was described in this article as a historical archaeologist, probably not lake sediments. I don't know if you can go back in the, quote, historical record unless you're looking at, like, you know, England or something, which has a 2,000-year historical record. But anyway, point is, she said that looking at some of the models, they were exposed to some of these climate models just for fun. They weren't even looking at them. They were just, you know, somehow they were shown them, and they're like, wait a minute, where's like the cities and towns and rice fields and grazing lands and all this stuff that has a major impact on climate when you start affecting the landscape like that? Maybe not a major effect immediately in the area, but when you put this across a huge space of, you know, land, that has a massive impact on the climate.
It really does. And so just so that I get my understanding correct here, they're using past climate to predict future climate, right?
Essentially.
Are they looking at climate from like 50 years ago or 500 years ago or both?
They're looking at climate from now to 10,000 years ago.
Okay, because the impact that humans are having on the climate is vastly different from what it was 50 years ago versus 500 years ago.
Right.
Are they taking into account, and you don't have to answer this if you don't know, but I wonder if they're taking into account human activity from 50 years ago, at least, because we're post-industrial age at that point. Like, obviously, that is going to be having a huge impact on the climate. And I wonder if their models are at least taking that into account, or is it not taking into account just the prehistoric stuff, basically? That's my question.
From what I can tell, and from what I've heard in things outside of this paper, yes, they are trying to perfect these models because the models are not doing a great job at predicting where we're like if you pretend it's 1950 and you put in that data and say, what is it going to be like in 2021? It's not very good at predicting what 2021 is like.
Right.
And part of the reason for that is we don't have good enough starting points. So yes, they're taking into account the last 100 years.
Yeah.
But the model's already flawed in that it didn't take into account the past 10,000 years.
Okay.
So it doesn't know how to take this dramatic human impact and put it in the model, let alone the minimal human impact of 1,000 years ago.
Okay.
Even though it was a human impact and it was minimal, it still has an impact on the model.
Right.
So what they're trying to do, There's apparently over 200 researchers have come together to create one of the world's first archaeological climate databases, where they're taking all this information that archaeologists have already collected, and they're just like sitting over their corner going, hey, I got some data over here.
Hey, guys.
And they're coming together to bring this data in a usable way, because you can't just, you know, go over to, quote, the model and say, here's a town.
Right.
Like, you'd have to quantify that somehow.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, what does that mean for the model? You have to translate the data that archaeologists have collected into the data that the climate scientists need in a way that will actually fit their model, mm-hmm. right? But that you can actually input it. So that's probably a really hard problem. And they are, well, first off, I'll talk about some of the models that they're trying to affect, two of the mm-hmm. bigger used ones. One is called the History Database of the Global Environment, or HYDE. And the other one's my favorite because it sounds like some, I don't know, Russian supervillain model or something like that. It's called KK10, which basically just is the initials of the authors that did it and the year 2010 when they created
it.
Gotcha. Yeah, but KK10 is my favorite. Really should be K-squared 10, but whatever.
Yeah.
Or 2K10.
Ooh, 2K10. That's cool.
Yeah. Anyway, so they're trying to improve these models because they're some of the ones that are more widely used. And yeah, so it's pretty cool that they're refining these. And even just refining some of the smaller impacts through time of all these different archaeological data sets mm-hmm. will help improve what we know now, even with the massive changes in the last 100 years.
Yeah, because a small change 5,000 years ago can end up having a big change mm-hmm. by the time you get to today. So that is going to be very interesting to see how that data impacts their findings overall.
Yeah, and of course, the end result of all this is that we know how to better plan for what we're doing now in the future, mm-hmm. right? I mean, a lot of people just aren't concerned about our climactic future because they're like, well, let our kids deal with it. But, you know, you're not wrong. You're going to be dead. So yeah. Who cares, right? But if you're concerned with the planet at all and your grandchildren, then
it's like not sustainable.
It's really not.
To continue the way we are. So we all need to care, at least a little bit.
And those climate deniers out there, I will say, you're right in that the Earth will probably heal itself and fix itself. And probably the end result of all this climate change is we'll just kill us. We'll probably kill a lot of other animals with it too, but we'll probably just kill us, which I agree. But you could end up with something like Venus. You know, now Venus is a lot closer to the sun, but they predict that Venus, when the sun was smaller, was because the sun's growing in size, right? So because that's how stars work like that. Eventually the sun is going to encompass the Earth and mm-hmm. we'll all be dead, but that's a couple billion years away. But the Venus, they say, used to have like an Earth-like atmosphere.
Oh.
Now there wasn't any people there, more than likely. I mean, I'm not going to say there wasn't. Maybe there was a civilization there, who knows? But probably because of its proximity to the sun, there was a runaway greenhouse effect on Venus, and you can't even set foot on the surface without special gear because A, there's no atmosphere, and B, you'll boil your blood and you'll die.
Right.
So we've sent probes into Venus, and like, I don't know if any probe has ever landed there and continued to transmit, but the minute they get like halfway through the atmosphere, they stop transmitting, probably because they melted to death.
Right.
Yes. So not that that's necessarily going to happen here, but if it does, it might be irreversible for the planet. At that point, who cares? Because we're all dead. But, you know, I think we'll get to the point where, like I said, we'll make it unsustainable for us. And then the planet will probably eventually heal itself over massive amounts of time.
Yeah.
But again, if we're concerned with us or the planet, who knows? So anyway, archaeologists saving the day again. So there you go. All right.
We are the heroes of science, the unsung heroes of science.
That's right. That's right. All right. Well, we're going to take a little bit of a turn for this next one. There's a lot of discussion around archaeology and religion and things like that. And I don't know anything about Judaism. I am not Jewish, but we're going to talk about something that I thought was pretty interesting for this article, and that's going to take us over to Israel. Back in a second. Chris Webster here for the Archaeology Podcast Network. We strive for high-quality interviews and content so you can find information on any topic in archaeology from around the world. One way we do that is by recording interviews with our hosts and guests located in many parts of the world all at once. We do that through the use of Zencastr. That's Zencastr. Zencastr allows us to record high-quality audio with no stress on the guest. Just send them a link to click on, and that's it. Zencastr does the rest. They even do automatic transcriptions. Check out the link in the show notes for 30% off your first 3 months, or go to zencastr.com and use the code TAS. Looking to expand your knowledge of x-rays and imaging in the archaeology field? Then check out An Introduction to Paleoradiography, a short online course offering professional training for archaeologists and affiliated disciplines. Created by archaeologist, radiographer, and lecturer James Elliott, the content of this course is based upon his research and teaching experience in higher education. It is approved by the Chartered Institute for Archaeologists as 4 hours of training. That's in the UK, for those of you that don't know. So don't miss out on this exciting opportunity for professional and personal development. For more information on pricing and course structure, visit paleoimaging.com. That's P-A-L-E-O imaging.com. And look for the link in the show notes to this episode. Welcome back to the Archaeology Show, episode 125. And we are moving straight over to Israel for this one. And this article actually is pretty good. We'll include this in the show notes. But they link to the journal of the Institute of Archaeology of Tel Aviv University, which is at Taylor and Francis. So this is a respected journal for the area, I assume. It wouldn't be on the Taylor and Francis website if it were not a real journal. I'm just saying that because I've never heard of it, but there you go, right?
Yep.
Anyway, this is really cool because it shows the collaboration and one of the needs for archaeologists to have conferences too, because there was an archaeologist in 2017 named, and I'm going to get his name wrong, but Yonatan Adler. And they were at a conference basically listening to speeches, listening to papers being delivered. And one of the researchers mentioned something that this guy was like, wait, what now? And basically it was that there was a lot of fish remains, and we'll define that term here in a second, unearthed in ancient Judean settlements. And they're specifically talking about first century BC and back, right?
Right.
Now, I'm going to give you what I learned from this article and from reading the paper, a few things here. First off, we don't call them fish bones because, well, three of the fish that were prominently found were catfish, skate, and shark. Catfish apparently have bones, but skate and shark do not. They're cartilaginous.
The cartilaginous, right?
Yeah. So they're not fish bones. We're just calling them fish remains.
Okay.
So there's that. And also, another thing here, when we're talking about these fish and why it's weird to find those, because fish go against the Torah or the teachings of the Jewish faith, which is, and it's called the ritual of kashrut, which is the rules that outline sustainable foods for human consumption. These species are non-kosher and unfit to eat.
Okay.
Now, they didn't really go into it. They said it has some, they said, listen, look this up if you want to. Basically, it's what the article said.
Right.
But it basically has something to do with the scales. If the scales aren't either like pointing the right way or they're non-existent, like I don't think catfish have scales, for example. They have like skin. And sharks have skin. Sharks don't have scales.
Yeah.
But if they don't have scales, I don't know if that's the only thing that makes them not kosher.
Right.
But it makes them like, the Jewish faith is like,
there's some gray area there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And check this out too. Something else I didn't know. Again, not Jewish. But according to rabbinic tradition, Moses, who is like the Uber Jew, according to them, like he's the big patron saint of Judaism, right? He's the Uber Jew, received the commandments that outlined how to live as a Jew sometime around the 13th century BC. That is a long time ago.
Very long time ago.
Yeah. So I don't know about that. But anyway, that's what tradition says. There goes a motorcycle, if you can hear it. Mm-hmm. Well, it's all Harleys, too. There's no other motorcycles in existence right now in the world. So anyway, they laid down these laws for how to be a Jew.
Right.
And they started following them. Nobody's really certain when these were written down into the Torah. Apparently, that's an open question. And the Torah is basically the Jewish Bible.
Yeah.
That's what all the, you know.
It's all, the collection of writings that they.
Yeah, it's like the Christian Bible, right? But it's for Judaism.
Yeah.
So if you want to be a Jew as a religion, you follow the Torah.
Yeah.
And they weren't really sure, though, like when this was written down. And when people really started following it, but 13 centuries back, 13th millennium BC actually is a long time ago. And the sites that we're talking about here are actually from the first millennium BC. So that's 12,000 years later. And there's still people going, I don't know about that book. But here's the thing that they were saying is they're trying to figure this out because there were a lot of Jewish settlements that had, and they studied over 20,000 fish remains from excavations dating around the mid part of the first millennium BC.
Uh-huh.
And they said that they found tons of that stuff. And a lot of it was in the regular person neighborhoods, not like the elite neighborhoods,
right?
The regular person neighborhoods. And they said that back in that time, your average Jewish farmer would have been illiterate. They just flat out would have been illiterate.
Uh-huh.
So they're not even reading the Torah.
Right.
Now, you don't have to read the Bible or the Torah to be religious. You just go to church, right?
Right.
So presumably they had temple or something like that.
Yeah.
They could have gone there. I'm sure they could hear the language. They could listen to it. They're
right.
not, you know, they're not deaf. So I'm not really sure why they weren't able to follow this. And they have to figure this out because they also found at some sites in northern Israel where they were just like straight up eating pork.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they're not supposed to eat that either. So
I think, I mean, this all 100% makes sense to me. And the reason it does is because when it comes down to it and you have to survive,
you can eat something.
You are going to eat something. And like, I just don't think that I'm sure there are religious people out there who would choose to starve to death rather than eat the thing that they're not supposed to eat. But I don't think that that applies to normal everyday people. So it actually makes even more sense to me that they found these remains in the neighborhoods of everyday working farmers and people like that, because you just, you have to eat.
Well, here's the thing too. You know, eating is hard when you got to get it all yourself, right?
Yeah.
You can't just go down to the grocery store and buy kosher foods.
Right.
So if you, I have no doubt that it took 10,000 years to convince people who had been living in that area and probably eating fish for 200,000 years to stop eating
to
fish
stop
because
doing
their
that.
God said it was bad.
Right.
Right? Like,
yeah,
to
how'd that
them.
Conversation go? Hey, guys, so I was reading this thing over here, and I know you can't read it, but I can, and it actually says that we really shouldn't be eating fish.
Yeah.
Also, I apologize to every Jewish person out there on behalf of both of us for not understanding anything about Judaism.
Literally know nothing about it.
Nothing about it.
I don't know anything about Christianity either, so I'm equally ignorant about everything. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess I'm about the same. I don't know anything about any religions.
Yeah, not really.
Yeah.
I mean, the Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster is pretty much the only thing I know. Ramen. Anyway.
Ramen.
So anyway, yeah, we're not trying to be disrespectful here.
No,
really, this
no.
is an archaeological conversation.
Yeah.
Because really, the biggest question here is, I was really surprised to find out that they don't actually know, is A, when was all this written down in the Torah? And B, when did Jewish people as a whole start following these traditions? And I mean, I'm sure there's Jewish people now that don't follow the traditions like any religion,
mm-hmm.
but they're just Jewish by ancestry and not by faith.
Mm-hmm.
But people of strict Jewish faith do follow these things. And back in the day, pretty much everybody would have been of that faith if they lived in that area, because
yeah.
that's how it worked. But when did widespread adoption begin with all this? Now, one
right.
thing that we do know from research is that these fish remains, for lack of a better way to say that, were almost completely gone. They said almost all scaleless fish remains. So definitely if it doesn't have scales, it's not a fish according to the Jewish faith, and you
okay.
can't eat it.
Okay.
But all of them nearly disappear completely by the time of around 324 AD or so during the Roman times.
Oh.
So it's gone. Is
okay.
it because... Is it because when the Romans came in, it was such a different thing? They just rallied around their faith, and part of rallying around their faith was really strictly
yeah,
adhering to the laws?
A more strict approach to
yeah.
the faith. Yeah, like that does make sense.
Yeah.
So I grew up in a Catholic home, and I'm looking at the practices and things that happened within my family, and like there are just some things that you relax.
Yeah.
Because it's just easier to live your life. Like, not eating meat during Lent is, like, really hard. So, or not even eating meat on Fridays, if that's your choice.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's just various ways of adhering to your religion. And I think that it comes down to personal choice and what works for you and your personal God. And
yeah.
a lot of, and I would imagine that with these kind of villages and these kind of small towns, that that's what happens, is that this like slow evolution happens within the religion of what works for them and their group and their religion. And then that becomes the new normal for them. And
right.
it's interesting to look at, really, because it's like a micro evolution of the religion within a place. And it's kind of cool to see that happening.
Yeah. And I don't have a lot of frame of reference here. I grew up kind of half religious. I mean, I went to like a Bible school camp when I was a kid, so I got exposed to that. I went
like
to,
once a year.
Yeah, once a year.
like you got religion like once a year.
Basically, kind of. Yeah.
Yeah.
We went to like vacation Bible school because the rest of the neighborhood did. So like
yeah.
once a week in the evening, we'd go sing songs, and we'd see pictures of the golden palaces that we would live in heaven. It was a very white, idealistic version of Christianity growing up in rural Seattle.
Oh my gosh.
Anyway, and my parents weren't really that. My mom tried taking us to church a few times, but she wasn't that religious either, so that kind of failed. My dad was like, football and NASCAR. And so he never went.
Your parents don't listen to this show.
Nope, they don't. So anyway, I just didn't grow up with that kind of frame of reference. Yeah. But it's interesting to me to look at all this, to just use the archaeological record to figure out and actually see religion and the rules of religion being adopted. Because it's easy to see like temples and stuff getting built. You can tell in an ancient city what religion was dominating by the sheer number of churches. Like if we were all wiped off the face of the earth today, you could go to some cities in America and go, my God, what is going on here? Because there's like 2,000 people, but 48 churches.
Right.
That says something about those people.
Yeah.
You know, and if you go there and there's like one church, but a whole bunch of bars, that says something else about the people, right? So It's just you can see it from that archaeological perspective, but looking at it from a food perspective, you can't do that with some other religions, because as far as I know, Judaism among the major world religions, and Hinduism as well with their not eating cows, you can see the religion in the remains and the archaeological record of the things they were eating, which is amazing.
Yeah, it's very cool to see the effect of religion on people's everyday life.
Right.
And in this case, a divergence from it, perhaps. Yeah. So, I mean, very cool.
Again, just to wrap this up, I can't imagine being told that this relatively abundant resource is now off limits for eating. You're going to have to figure something else out.
Right.
You know, because I want to know not only if they were not allowed to eat this, I would also want to see through that time span, like going back through the archaeological record and the sites that have already been excavated, what did you see an increase in?
Yeah, because they have to replace that with something, right?
They got
to
eat something.
Or was it too gradual to notice, maybe?
Well, they noticed this.
They did.
They noticed the drop-off. They noticed its existence, and they noticed the drop-off.
Yeah.
There must be an increase in something else, or they just ate less. I don't know. Maybe there was already a lot of other stuff, and they just dropped this out, and maybe there wasn't an increase. I mean, who knows, right?
Yeah.
Like, how much fish were they possibly eating?
Yeah, right? And it could have been like a replacing protein with plant.
Because we're not
options.
We're not saying they had an all fish diet.
Right, right.
Yeah, I mean, fish was just part
farmers,
of the diet.
So they were definitely, they had grains of some sort.
They lived at the sea. Yeah. You know, Israel's right on the Mediterranean.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they. I've been to Haifa. I mean, it's like literally right there. Sailed up in a really small, you know, United States nuclear aircraft carrier, and just kind of hung out there for a while. So I mean, it's like right there.
Yeah.
So anyway. All right. Well, if you're Jewish, please don't hate us and send us hate mail.
Yeah, like but, we like legit don't know what we're talking about when it comes to the religion stuff. So we did our best.
If you like what we had to say and you thought it was interesting, then leave us a comment. If you don't, you can email us at Tristan@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Back for segment three in a minute. You may have heard my pitch for membership. It's a great idea and really helps out. However, you can also support us by picking up a fun t-shirt, sticker, or something from a large selection of items from our Tee Public store. Head over to arcpodnet.com/shop for a link. That's arcpodnet.com/shop to pick up some fun swag and support the show.
Welcome back to episode 125 of The Archaeology Show. And we are moving just a little bit away to Greek and Roman times and places. I am so smart today.
Yes. Now, this is an article. I can't remember how I found it, but and I honestly didn't really realize that the Journal of Archaeological Science, where I found this, actually does this and why they do it. But they released the abstract for an article that's coming out in their July 2021 issue. Now, the July 2020 issue. 2021. The July 2021 issue is probably coming out in June. That's kind of how that works.
Yeah, they do seem to run it like a month ahead. Yeah.
But they released the abstract ahead of time. I don't know.
You know, you got to like raise interest,
I guess.
In those archaeological papers that are coming out soon.
Well, anyway, this one is called Model for Ancient Greek and Roman Coinage Production. And this is really dense. I'm looking forward to see what the actual paper is, but I thought I'd talk about it anyway because it was pretty interesting to me. When it says model for ancient Greek and Roman coinage production, some archaeologists like to put together actual mathematical models to see if they can make predictions off of that. That's why you make a model.
Right.
It's like our climate model from the first segment. They're trying to figure out, using the dyes that were used to cast coins in early Greek and Roman cities, towns, areas, They're trying to figure out, well, what was the quality of these dyes? Did people know what they were doing?
And by dye, you don't mean, you know, a little thing that you roll when playing a game.
No.
It's like a mold, essentially,
yes,
for the coins themselves, right?
Yeah, and this mold, according to the article, that's a good segue, has to have two basic features. First, it has to not fail, which means crack or fall apart. Because when you're pouring molten bronze into it.
Oh, yeah. That material has got to be sturdy.
Yeah. And I don't even know if some of the early coins even had two sides, right? If they had two sides, that means your mold is actually, you pour it down in through a hole.
Yeah.
Not into like a flat thing like chocolate, right?
Right.
So I don't know, unless they used a stamp for the other side, but I'm not really sure how they would do that.
I'm not sure.
But I think that when they cast something, anytime you say they're casting it, typically you're pouring it down inside.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that the way that they kind of do that now is they make the model out of wax, and then they build the casted material around it, whatever they're using for that. I actually don't even know.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever they're using that can withstand the heat of molten bronze, they put that around the wax and then they build that up. Then they fire it like clay in an oven. In fact, it might be that. They fire it like clay in an oven. The wax melts and goes away, and they pour it out, and then they can just pour molten bronze into it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know if they have to make one of these for each coin, which seems pretty wasteful, or if it really is like a flat thing. But the whole point of this article is talking about how they tried to use a typical, it's called a Kaplan-Meier failure analysis that engineers use, and you get what's called a bathtub curve. So high on the sides and low in the middle. This is the failure curve that's typical of something like this from an engineering standpoint. But the interesting thing is these didn't follow that curve.
So does that mean that they would fail initially and then be fine? A lot of them were fine for a while and then fail near the end. Is that what that kind of curve is meaning?
The only point is of the 29 that they looked at, they didn't hit this distribution curve of these were good at the beginning and end and these failed in the middle. It should follow this curve for most things, but it just didn't. That's the whole point. So then they were trying to find something else in the Weibull distribution, apparently. I had to look that up. It's a special case out of more general class of distribution functions for flaws whose size frequency distribution decreases with increasing flaw size corresponding to a power law. So basically, there's a lot of math here. What they ended up determining with all this stuff was that essentially not all workshops got it right.
Okay.
So
that makes sense.
There were a lot of failures.
Yeah.
And I can imagine that's true because, you know, casting coins and stuff for the presumably for the government. Was probably a pretty lucrative business.
Yeah.
And a lot of people would want to get into it.
Right.
You know, you got a lot of probably blacksmiths and metalworkers out there that are like, I could do that.
Yeah.
But you might be able to hammer out a sword pretty nice, but making a die to cast your bronze coins seemed to be really, really difficult.
Yeah.
And that's what the thrust of this article really is it's saying that finding a good mint, a mint is something that only casts coins and stuff like that. Finding one that has mastered this dye technology was really hard to find.
Yeah.
And that's why when you look, if you just like Google image search Roman or Greek ancient coins, you're going to see a lot of shapes and a lot of variability.
Yeah.
And it's a reason why a lot of them changed a lot too, because, you know, they'd make a few. It's still bronze. It's still worth something.
Yeah.
You know, they probably did it in gold and stuff like that too, but this one specifically looked at bronze ones. But, silver coinage. I'm sorry. They do bronze and silver is what this article talked about. But anyway, regardless, it was really hard to do that. It was really hard to make something that was heat resistant enough that wouldn't crack. It was hard to make something that the good failure rate for these things is it fails after long periods of use, not obviously at some point. And the other thing I thought was really strange about this, and I don't know if this is a common term for engineering and failure models, but or if the archaeologists came up with this. But they said the ones that failed early on, they used the phrase infant mortality. And I'm like, what?
The little baby molds, they died.
I mean,
so sad.
It just seemed like a really weird phrase to use.
It
for
is
this.
Very strange. You don't normally think of it.
I mean, it's kind of triggering, I would imagine.
I know. You think of it as like human babies, not not mold babies.
No, mold babies. I was reading they've got the highlights at the top of this article. If you look at the link in the show notes, and it mentions, I think it mentions there. Oh, maybe it doesn't. It just mentions it in the abstract. It mentions. Oh, it does mention it in the highlights, the fourth one down. It mentions infant mortality and ductile deformation during minting. Those are two things. Like infant mortality is it's failing early, and ductile deformation. I had to look that up too. It basically means it's not the right shape.
Oh.
Yeah, something's not right. It's not holding.
Yeah.
It's bleeding out or the details aren't right. It's just not a good coin, right? Which seems, that seems to me like it's more likely the case than, you know, an early one failing because that's got to be hard to get right. But anyway, looking forward to the paper coming out. Maybe we'll talk about it again. I figured with this, the density of this paper right here, we might have to wait for someone else to summarize it that really knows what they're talking about, because this paper is going to be a lot of formulas and just like, you know, everything. So,
yeah, but I'm interested in the conclusions, because the whole gist of the article is that this particular type of dye is not having the same curve that they're used to seeing. So why?
Right.
Like what... And I guess we'll have to wait for the article to see the why, but but why?
Yeah, and it's very likely that as you're listening to this podcast, the article's already out. So go ahead.
Yeah,
because I don't know what they... I mean, it's...
June is in a couple days.
And they don't necessarily release them June 1st. They just release them before. So it could be out now.
Yep.
Anyway, go check it out. It's supposed to be open access, which is another reason why I chose it. So when it does come out, you'll be able to read the whole thing. So
cool.
All right. Well, that's it for this time. Thanks for listening. I think I mentioned this last time, but we've revitalized our newsletter. Now, the newsletter for the first week of June comes out Memorial Day is on Mondays. It's always news articles. And it just happens to be because I like these three articles. So, you know, if you listen to this show, you're a step ahead of the game. But also, we have links to our T Public store in there with certain things that I like to highlight. There's a Memorial Day sale going on, so if you're listening to this in real time, you can get anything on our store off, 35% off. And if you don't want to use the newsletter, you can go to arcpodnet.com/shop to find our link to our T Public store. Or you can go to tpublic.com and just type in Archaeology Podcast Network. Also, on Fridays, we're releasing a newsletter that basically highlights all of the podcasts we released in the past 7 days, from that Friday on back to the previous Saturday. So, and again, more links to the TeePublic store on the bottom. We'll always highlight different designs, but you can get whatever you want. So,
yep, there you go. Check it out.
All right. We're going to go try to navigate through the motorcycles and get on to our next stop. We're actually doing some archaeological field work, so who knows what we're going to have on the podcast coming up in the future. But we got 2.5 months of high desert survey coming up.
Yep.
All right, thanks everybody, and we'll see you next week.
See ya.
Thanks for listening to The Archaeology Show. Feel free to comment and view the show notes on the website at www.arcpodnet.com. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at ArcPodNet. You can also find us on the Lyceum app, a podcast app just for educational podcasts. Music for this show is called I Wish You Would Look from the band Sea Hero. Again, thanks for listening and have an awesome day. This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV Traveling America, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US dollars a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to archpodnet.com/members for more info.